Thank you so much for coming to the early lunch today, ladies and gentlemen. It's so kind of you to come here today. We're only here thanks to our great sponsor, Charles Stanley. So thank you so much. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the stratosphere. And I am a poor substitute for the late, great Barry Cryer, who did this job so much better than me. And we publish a weekly joke by him, which still takes up a third of our website hits. Only at the oldie will a late comedian be top of the charts. And his latest joke, which is doing very well on the website, he was always very good at recognizing his fellow comics. And he talked about an American comic called Alan King, who said, "I'm 62 and people call me middle-aged. How many 124-year-olds do you know?" We've got three terrific writers here today, and the first is one of our greatest historians. At the callow age of 24, he wrote In Xanadu and has written many best-selling histories since, including From the Holy Mountain, A Journey in the Shadow of Byzantium. And his latest book is The Golden Road, How Ancient India Transformed the World. Ladies and gentlemen, Willie Durham.
It's a great pleasure to be here. James was at college with me, and I have to say I'm very worried to see him a teetotal at lunch and refuse sticky toffee pudding. It's something unheard of in the history, I'm sure, of the elderly. But he looked at the sticky toffee pudding and quaked and turned it away. So I don't know what this means for the future of this magazine, but it's a worrying moment. I thought I'd put it down there for you all before. The book I've just written, The Golden Road, is the first book I've written about India for 25 years that hasn't been about the colonial period. I've been writing about the East India Company and the moguls and all that sort of stuff. And this is about a much, much earlier period of history, which is what actually first drew me to India, aged 18, 40 years ago. This was the wonders of ancient India. I went in 1984, went round the Ellora and Ajanta caves, the extraordinary early burial mounds in Sanchi, and fell in love with this extraordinary ancient history, but somehow ended up writing about the 18th century, and have now come back to really what was my first love. And I've had five fantastic years tracing the diffusion of Indian ideas out of India. Because India, like Greece, in a way that we're very familiar with Greece, beamed out and diffused its answers to the big questions. Why are we here? What is our purpose on earth? What should we achieve? How do we live our lives? How do we count, enumerate, and divide this world we live in? And if you grew up in this country, as I'm sure most of you did, you will know the Greek answers to those questions, and you will know the names of people like Pythagoras and Archimedes since primary school, because these were people we all learn about. But just out of interest, how many people in this room have heard of Aryabhatta or Brahmagupta? Put your hands up if any of you have heard of it. One. Aryabhatta, Brahmagupta, between them, basically came up with the idea of zero and the numbers we all use every day. Absolutely essential to modern life, to life since in Europe since the 12th century. The nearest thing the human race has to a universal language, because their answers to that question have been used in every country in the world. And yet, their stories are completely unknown to us here in the West. And this is part of a wider absence. Well, I think probably because of the attitudes of colonialism, we never learned the extraordinary things that India did. Ever since Macaulay famously said that a good shelf of English books is better than the entire native literature of India and Arabia. this stuff simply hasn't been taught in our schools. And today we love Macaulay saying that, but we don't know the Indian story. So this book tries to bring it all together in one book. It's only, there's 200 pages of notes, but it's only 300 pages of text. And it tries to gallop through India's contribution to world civilizations. And there are various different heads. The book kind of opens with something which, again, I think we're completely unaware of, that India was the Roman Empire's biggest trading partner. Pliny talks about how India was the sink of all the precious metals in the world. Strabo mentions that at one port, Maius Hormus on the Red Sea, 250 vessels left in a single fleet each year with the monsoon winds to trade with India. And recent figures that Oxford have come up with, based on something called the Musiris Papyrus, which is an extraordinary set of shipping documents taken out by an Alexandrian shipping owner in the first century AD to a supplier in Kerala. From that, they've calculated that maybe as much as one third of the entire Roman imperial budget came from the customs take of the import of Indian luxuries, pepper, ivory, various different materials for perfume, including nard, which if you remember in the Gospels, Martha, was it Mary, spears on the feet of Christ, wild animals for the circuses, cottons and silk. And this extraordinary world is completely unfamiliar to us, not least because over the last 40 years we've all been wooed with this very romantic idea of the Silk Road, which I don't believe existed at all at this period. There is a recent map produced in Oxford of Roman coin hoards, and as you can imagine, the coins all over the Mediterranean, on the North African coast, all over Europe, thinning out as they go northwards into Germany and Russia and Scotland. But there is this enormous concentration of Roman gold coins found all over India and Sri Lanka. And this is stuff which people just aren't aware of. There is not one Roman coin, however, ever been found in China. Other than about, I think there's six in a tomb as a decoration. No Roman coin hoards have been found in China. So we need to kind of forget this idea at this period. The Silk Road existed by the time of Marco Polo in the 13th century after the Mongols smashed a hole through the narrow waste of Asia, linking the Mediterranean with the South China Sea. But in the Roman period, it was India that was the focus of Roman trade and Indian luxuries that Pliny, who is a sort of familiar sort of Harumphy naval commander that you could meet in one of Patrick's books today, who can't see why Roman women want to wear silk or smear this horrible, pungent new substance called pepper all over their food. And this is a trade that goes both ways. We've recently started finding a great deal of Buddhist material in Egypt, raising the question whether Buddhist monasticism, which exists three centuries before Christian monasticism, could have been an influence on St. Anthony and the early desert fathers in Egypt. Equally, you have Buddhist missions setting off and first taking over Central Asia and Afghanistan, and then traveling over to China. And Buddhism is an Indian religion. The Buddha, who came up with an idea of how you end suffering in the 5th century BC. His ideas spread slowly around North India for a couple of hundred years, and then they ricochet around the world when the Emperor Ashoka makes it the state religion in India. He sends missionaries as far as Cyrene, which is modern Libya, but also all over India to Sri Lanka. And then Sri Lanka itself becomes another base of Buddhism. And you find Buddhism, this set of Indian religious ideas becoming increasingly popular, not just in India and Central Asia, but increasingly in China itself. And then this extraordinary woman, Wu Zetian, makes it the state religion in China. Wu Zetian is a fifth ranking concubine in the emperor's bedroom. When the old emperor is dying, he somehow manages to cling on to the crown prince, and so is rescued from the monastery, or nunnery, into which all the concubines and empresses are put, the emperor's death, becomes the empress herself, having first framed the previous empress and had her murdered. Within a few years, her husband, the new emperor, has mysteriously died from strange illness, and she becomes the only woman emperor in her own right in 3,000 years of Chinese domestic history. And what she does to back her up against the Confucians, who don't like women taking over, is she converts China to Buddhism. So very briefly, you have this moment when China takes on an Indian religion as the state faith. And with that comes Indian astrologers, Indian astronomers, and particularly graduates of the great ancient Indian University of Nalanda, which was the main, like what the Library of Alexandria was to the Mediterranean world, Nalanda was to Asia. It has colleges set up by different countries across Asia at this place in Bihar, in central India. And it's the Oxford, the Ivy League, the NASA of its day, to which students come from hundreds of miles away. At the same time, Hinduism and Hindu ideas are spreading through Southeast Asia, so that the largest temple in the world, the largest Hindu temple in the world, is built not in India, but in Cambodia, at Angkor Wat. And again, this whole story is one that we're very, very unfamiliar with. The civilization of Angkor, the Khmer Empire, there was 1 million citizens living in Greater Angkor when London had 20,000 people. It was this vast Hindu empire which stretches across the whole of modern Southeast Asia. But ironically, while Southeast Asia has now become 8 or 9 different kingdoms, Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, and so on, India, which was 70 kingdoms at that time, is now one united country. Possibly, you could say, thanks to Lord Curzon and Robert Clive. So India, we now think of as a united place, when in fact it was, for most of its history, fractured. Which is why in India, the place that dreamt up the big Buddhist and Hindu ideas, the temples are relatively small. While when you go to Angkor Wat, the area within the outer moat is alone 4 times the size of the Vatican City. It is the largest religious monument on earth. And it is in a very Indian style. But what's interesting is that India is like, if you like, the garden that produces astonishing seeds, which, when planted elsewhere, grow in strange ways. And the Buddhism of Java and Hinduism of Southeast Asia is very different from the Hinduism of India. For example, there's no caste. People eat pork. There are women Brahmins. So all this is very, very strange and interesting. But the way India affected us, in a way that we don't know, is the numbers we use every day. They were dreamt up in India in the first century. The Emperor Ashoka makes them in use across the whole of India. And then in the 7th century, a series of Buddhist abbots who converted to Islam bring them into Baghdad. And it becomes the Arab system. We borrow it from the Arabs, so we call them Arabic numbers. But they are not. In origin, they are Indian. And the person who brings them from the Arab world to Italy is the mathematician Fibonacci, who happened to be brought up as an expat kid in Algeria, and just at the local primary school, learns these new numbers, which are in use by that stage all over the Arab world. While in Europe, people are still trying to do multiplication by MCVV1X times CVMMMV. And Fibonacci arrives back home aged 18 to find his contemporaries struggling with all this and writes a book called the Liber Abaci, the book of calculation and balancing by the Hindu method. And he says how the Hindus have developed this extraordinary technique with only 9 numbers and the symbol 0. All completely new in the West at that point. It's taken up by the Emperor Frederick II, and from there it spreads out. Piero della Francesca, who we all think of as the greatest of the Renaissance painters, is renowned at the time as primarily a mathematician, and his ideas and perspective were all developed from reading Fibonacci's version of these Indian mathematical techniques. And he writes 3 mathematical treatises, which are then plagiarized by a friar called Friar Caroli, And it's these that give birth to the Italian banking revolution that produces the Medici, double counting, and in time, you could argue, the rise of the West. So you can at least make an argument that it is the economic weight of the West, after they've learned Indian numbers and Indian accounting and Indian banking and Indian interest rates, that creates the sort of corporation like the East India Company, which then goes back and conquers India in a very unfortunate vicious circle if you're Indian, but to the enormous enrichment of this country. So this book tells the story of the forgotten contribution of India to all our lives. It's one of the foundations of our world, but we have forgotten it. Thank you. Bravo.